So we've been sitting for a while since we started. And the lingering pain is unavoidable. Physical, mental. Obviously there are difficulties. There are challenges. It's okay for a couple of hours, but then it builds up. And then you probably ask yourself, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Voluntary restriction, what's the point? Isn't there an easier way to figure out true nature? Who I am. Maybe you think you know who you are. So there's no work to be done at all. It's interesting to see how the thinking mind, how clever the thinking mind is. How it knows exactly where to get you, when to get you, and how to get you. Comes in from the back door. And it's going to try and convince you to go back to where you were asleep and it was awake. When it was in charge. How do we clarify? What is to clarify? You know, you sit, you read a book, look at some spirituality, whatever that is, and then let's go watch a movie. It's okay, it's enough for today. I'll go back to it tomorrow. And try it again. It's okay, I got what I needed from that. It doesn't quite work like that. As in anything, depth doesn't just happen. And there is a price, always there is a price to pay. The price of comfort, the price of the familiar, the price of knowing, the price of expecting, assuming it'll be the way I want it to. Before yoga, you ended up sitting longer. You did not expect that. But so what? There is a schedule. Schedule can change. Schedule is not there to accommodate us. Schedule is there to teach us something. Story that I read about Suzuki Roshi in California when he was alive. He was leading a sesshin and the Jikido made a mistake. Woke up everybody at 3:30 instead of 4:30. Everybody including Suzuki Roshi. He got up, went to the Zendo, started to sit. Everybody else realized, this is too early, I'm going to go back to sleep. He was there alone for an hour, sitting. At 4:30, everybody woke up, showed up, went into the Zendo. And that morning, he was the one carrying the Kyosaku. And everybody felt it. Everybody. He was pissed off. Why are you here? What's the point? You go all the way, you go all the way. If you go partial way, you go partial. Whatever you put in is what you get out. If you expect nothing, you will understand nothing. You expect something, you are already staying in the world of limitation, not willing to step out. You say, I'm going to walk towards the fence, look around and go back. That's it. That's as far as I'm willing to go. I don't know what's behind that fence. I want the manicured lawn. I want the manicured, and I want the familiar. I want to know what I'm stepping on. I want to know how it's going to be. But we don't know how it's going to be. Even when there is a schedule. I remember more than once going to Sishin, expecting things to be a certain way as it was on the schedule, and it wasn't. There was one time there was supposed to be a Dharma talk. There was no Dharma talk. We said five periods straight. Nothing happened. And of course, I was waiting for something to happen. And I started to feel it. My mind was my mind was waiting for some kind of entertainment. And it did not get what it wanted. It's the beauty of what we do. We don't feed it. Every day of our lives, we feed it, we give it what it wants. And it's used to that. Why wouldn't it rebel? It's not going to give up so easy. To practice not knowing is to really practice not knowing. This is not a joke. It's real. And it's urgent, really urgent. Sometimes I think we don't understand how urgent it is. But all we have to do is just open the newspaper, TV, internet, look at the world around us. All it takes. Look how lost we are as humanity. There's a lot of sanity in the practice, but none of it is conceptualized, none of it is an idea. It's real. It's real, and you are not there. You, as you know yourself, are not there. You, as you don't know yourself, a different story. Discipline is essential. People say Zen practice is difficult. There are other ways to practice. More in tune with our times. More accommodating, easier. But what does easy have to do with that? What does it matter if it's easy or it's difficult? Why do we run away from the difficult towards the easy, expecting change? It doesn't change. But that's what your thinking mind wants. It'll tell you, okay, well, you want to practice spirituality, fine. How about that group over there? They take breaks more often. They sit 10 minutes a period. Seems better. The coffee is way better. Because it knows you like coffee, doesn't it? It knows. It knows you well. But you know yourself way better. If only you give it time. If only you practice sincerely. If only you stop believing what you think. If you don't go with every thought, every whim, automatically. Oh, I gotta cater to this, I have to take care of that. Otherwise what? What's gonna happen? What's gonna happen if you don't? You dive into not knowing, not giving into. You know the story, that's where you come from, that's where we come from, but what about what we don't know? Chogyam Trungpa talked about it, wrote about it in his introduction to this book, Hazy Moon of Enlightenment. He said, as long as there is a need for clearing away clouds of confusion, there is a path. In fact, the concepts of sudden and gradual are merely mental flickers. In either case, when the student begins to have a longing or passion for Buddha nature as his prize, that in itself is an obstacle. Sometimes we find that very dedicated students have difficulty in making progress. When there is some freedom combined with tremendous exertion and practice, freedom combined with practice. Interesting idea. Then Buddha nature begins to shine through. But it seems to be dangerous to talk too much about Buddha nature, as we might formulate a mental image of it. Because that's the familiar. That's the logical, that's the conceptualized, that's in the realm of the thinking mind. We love the idea, but the practice is a different story. He goes on to say that when this twofold right motive of non-harming and of awakenings, non-harming and awakening, begin to develop in the practitioner, then the sense of stillness begins to dawn. In this case, stillness is not something distinguished from motion. It is stillness without beginning or end. In this stillness, five eyes of the Buddha begin to open, so that finally, jhana, which is zazen, will give birth to prajna, which is wisdom, which is the sixth paramita of the bodhisattva path. Prajna, or discriminating awareness, is a two-edged sword which cuts oneself and others simultaneously. It cuts all delusions. At the level of the emergence of prajna, the experience of samadhi becomes apparent. Samadhi means being there or holding acutely. According to the sutras, there are millions of samadhis, but they all simplify into two approaches. Sugata, which is well gone, and tathagata, gone as it is. Both achieve the tatata, which is as it is, suchness, isness, as it isness. It is very soothing to talk about these things. However, very true. It is very soothing to talk about these things. We sit around the table, swap ideas of spirituality. Oh, how wonderful it is. And how luminous we feel. How much nonsense that is. And how removed from practice that is. We don't need to carry a badge. We don't need to show it. We need to be it. And it says, if there is no exertion and wakefulness, we are not even finger painting. It's a beautiful analogy. We're not even finger painting. Or sometimes we say in Zen, we are playing with mud balls. It's not the real thing. We are deceiving ourselves in the name of the Dharma. And then he says, I feel that the existence of the practice tradition is the only hope. It alone can wage war against ego. It alone is the way that we can comprehend the Dharma. I thought about this. I read it a while ago at our center. And I wanted to read it again here. Because we often encounter resistance to prostrations, the practice of prostration, or what we call ritual, or the chanting, and all that stuff, that traditional stuff. There are lay lineages out there. But the reality is that most lay lineages don't last. They die out within a couple of, maybe 2-3 generations, if that. What we are practicing is a 2,500-year-old tradition. And we are doing it not because there is some kind of an authority or a church or an organization that is controlling it. There is no body that is controlling that. And yet, it's alive. And it's not alive in the cushion. It's alive in you. You are its life. It has no breath. If you do not inhale and exhale, it is dead. When you inhale, the Buddha takes a deep breath. The Buddha is the one seeing through these eyes, listening to this talk. This is not foreign. This is not quaint, and this is not an idea. This is as real as it gets. It's just that, again, we prefer idea over reality. Look at what happens now in this retreat. Look how many times you ran away to thinking. Look at it honestly, you'll see. How often it gets boring, gets a little odd, weird. I gotta think about something. Of course, the mind needs to chew on something. It always wants something. It's got a voracious appetite for more, not for something specific, just for more. Hence the hungry ghost that we are. More for the sake of more, not for the sake of satisfaction, because there is no satisfaction. Even when you get what you want, it never lasts. The thing may last. The thing itself may last way after you. It's just that you lose interest in it because it did not do it. It did not do the trick. Well, maybe I should go and get something else. Different practice, different shirt, different shoes. Different spiritual materialism, right? I mean, we jump from one thing to another thinking, well, maybe there's a better practice out there. Discipline is essential. Extremely important. Without that, there is no practice. And what we do when we bow, what we do when we light incense, when we chant, is upholding that, upholding the life of the Buddha, the life. Bowing for us seems odd in our culture. It's a strange act, right? There's subserviency. I am lowering myself in front of something else. And obviously, if somebody is looking from the outside, somebody is bowing on this cushion towards that statue, well, this is your God. And you guys are worshipping that thing. But the eyes deceive us. It's like a magician. I heard about this pickpocket, actually. There was this guy who somehow was known as the best pickpocket in the world. I don't know how they figured this out, but he demonstrated that. And he was in a room with a lot of people, and they all knew he's the guy. And he told them, I'm going to pickpocket. I'm going to take stuff from you, from your wallet. I mean, take your wallet, take your watch. As we are talking. Not only he did that, he actually took a watch from one person, put it on another person's wrist, took the wallet from one person and put it in another person's pocket. It's quite amazing. And he said, when he was asked about it, he said that the way he does it is he makes you see what he wants you to see. He knows how to draw your attention to where he wants it to be, so that he can do what he needs to do. So the mind is like that. Our thinking mind is quite like that. Has a lot of experience in it. It'll trick you to see what it wants you to see. Because it knows that it lives on that, because it knows that if it doesn't do that, it'll be its end. Because you will take charge. Because you will take control. Because you will become the master. That's the end of its life. That would be Mara, ego, devil, whatever you call it. And sometimes when we talk about it like this, it seems as if it's the bad guy. We have to eliminate, shoot it, kill it. And that's not the way to work with it. What we need to do is to see that it has no power, unless you give it power. It has no power over you. Thoughts come up in Zazen. Actually, not just in Zazen. You could be walking around here and experience a lot of judgmental thoughts, Why is he doing this? Why is she doing that? Why don't we have more oranges? The rice is too bland. I don't like that. Constantly. Something else. Something different. Goes on and on. And if you see that, if you see the judgment or judgments or any other thought come up, look at it. That's what we do. We learn to look. We learn to observe. We learn to turn the lights on and see what's happening. Here is the thought. Okay. Where is the problem? It comes up. It begs for attention, for energy, for food. Fork in the road. Do you see the fork? Do you understand that you don't have to go that way? It's just that the noose is so tightly clasped on the nose that as soon as it comes, it gets hooked on it, and there we go. Like a moth to the light. We get burned, but we don't learn, because we do it again. And when you do it, when you see that there is a fork, when you see that there is an option, I don't have to go anywhere. I can stay here. It's comfortable, it's not comfortable, it's irrelevant. I like it, I don't like it, it's also irrelevant. Doesn't matter. And if you keep doing it over and over and over and over again, you get good at it. And there comes a time that it's just the way things are. You know, your judgments, your thoughts, your memories, your longings, your hopes become white noise. You lose interest. You really lose interest in going anywhere, in feeding it. And it loses control. It loses power. You know, the Sishins bring up naturally bring up stuff, because we are not distracted, because we are not in motion, we are not giving the mind something to chew on, we are not bombarded by stuff or creating stuff. And then memories come up, pain, maybe we wish things would have been differently than the way they turned out. Regrets. And that's good. It's good not because it feels good. It's good because we need to work on it. And this is an opportunity to work on it. To do things differently. Not the same way. Differently. And we can do that. You can do that. I have no doubt you can do that. You know, as a teacher, well, even saying that is a little odd. Because essentially, everybody's got it. Nothing is given from one person to another. We are selling water by the river, but you know, we brand our type of water. This is special water. Put some flavor in it. But everybody's got it. There's really nothing special about it. And that's what makes it so amazingly special. But as a teacher, I'm just a mirror. A mirror. That's all I can do. That's all I need to do. A mirror to you, a mirror to who you are, not who you think you are. That I will take away from you. So you're left standing on nothing, not knowing who you are. And then you ask, what's left? Who am I? Who am I when everything I rely on, I learn to rely on, I come to rely on, is gone? What's left?